Hi, this is Marlena Lieberg welcoming you to Blind Spot. Blind Spot is a series of programs heard this time each week on ACB Radio, where we talk no-tech, low-tech kinds of things. If you've got an idea for something you'd like to hear on Blind Spot, why not drop me an email? My email address is Marlena, that's M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. Hello, and welcome to Blind Spot. This is Marlena Lieberg. Blind Spot is heard this time each week on ACB Radio. And as I say in my promo, if you have any kind of thing that you would like to hear aired, or if you yourself are doing something that's interesting and would like to be interviewed and featured on Blind Spot, please drop me an email. I do want to keep Blind Spot a user-defined, listener-defined program. So please feel free to contact me. We have a very special program this evening, and in fact, Blind Spot is running for an hour this week instead of our usual 30 minutes. When I was a little girl, the first talking books I ever read in the NLS program was Heidi. And one of the things that fascinated me so much about Heidi was that the story took place in mountains in the Swiss Alps. And I was so taken by what the mountains looked like, how big they were, what it felt like. And as a congenitally blind person, I never really had much of a reference to kind of form a picture of mountains. Now, since that time, I've been in mountains, I've stood on the top of mountains, and so I have developed a picture of what works for me as a mountain and a mountain range. My interest in mountains was recently revived when my husband and I read Jonathan Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air. Jonathan Krakauer is a Seattle-based mountaineer who did a trek recently to Mount Everest, and it actually was a fatal trek for several of the people involved. But through that book, through reading that book, I learned a great deal about the challenge, the hazards, and the allure that the great mountains can offer. And on Blind Spot this week, I have the pleasure of interviewing someone who has made that trek, who has survived, who has stood on the top of the world and returned to be able to tell his story. What makes Tom Whitaker's story even more unique is that not only is Tom the first person with a disability ever to have scaled Mount Everest, but his team, who trekked with him and for him to the Mount Everest base camp at 17,200 feet, an altitude at which half of the oxygen in the atmosphere disappears, was primarily composed of people with disabilities. And I just think that's a pretty incredible thing. I feel honored to have Tom with us tonight and to hear his story. So Tom, on behalf of ACB Radio and Blind Spot in particular, welcome. And I look forward to just kind of sitting back and letting you talk to us and tell us your story.
Well, Marlena, it's an absolute pleasure to be here and be talking with you. I came into the disability field in a direct way. I worked with people with disabilities for 10 years, running a program with the rather alarming name of the Cooperative Wilderness Handicap Outdoor Group, or CW HOG, or just the Hogs, as we called ourselves. And it was run out of Idaho State University's outdoor program, which was a student service, or is a student service, at Idaho State University. And although I no longer direct the program, after 20 years, I'm still a lifetime member of the board and still do adventures with the hog. The other night, I was woken up at 2 a.m. in the morning, and I answered my phone, and there were a bunch of hogs partying up in Pocatello, and they'd all had plenty of alcoholic beverages by that time, and they thought, darn, let's give Whitaker a call. And they said, well, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Never mind. If we're up, Whitaker should be up. And so they called me up anyway. And so I partied with them on the phone a little while, and then they let me go. But, yeah, they still torment me. And
well, that's good. It will keep you humble, Tom.
Oh, gosh, it does. It keeps me humble, and it keeps me connected by the heart to these people.
Well, Tom, how did this all get started? What led you into working in the therapeutic recreation field for people with disabilities?
The way I came into this was literally through the windshield of a VW bus. I was driving along a narrow, deserted road on Thanksgiving night in 1979. Through an area of Idaho called the Craters of the Moon. I'd left Blackfoot, and I was driving on my way to Sun Valley. It was late at night. There was spindrifts blowing over the road, and I saw these two pinpricks of light way off across the desert coming towards me, and I got this strangest feeling that these headlamps that I was seeing were going to come into my lane and hit my vehicle head on. And it was just a two-lane highway with no way to pull off, and on either side of the road was just lava rock, and it was nowhere to go. And my strongest urge was to pull into this other vehicle's lane and have that so that the vehicle would pass me by and not run into me. And I thought, no, Whitaker, this doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So my only other option was to stop the car. And after the accident, when they did the measurements, they reckoned that I was traveling at 8 miles an hour at time of impact, and the other vehicle was traveling at 55 miles an hour.
Wow.
And I sustained massive injuries to both legs. And the only thing that actually kept me alive was this premonition, because I had been traveling without my seatbelt on, and I put my seatbelt on as a result of that, and I also basically stopped my vehicle.
Wow.
And if I'd been traveling at 45, 50 miles an hour at the time of impact, we'd have had a total speed of around about 100 miles an hour, and I doubt I would have survived.
Wow.
So anyway, who knows where some of this stuff comes from, but boy, it was, I guess that's how I got involved in becoming a professional working in therapeutic recreation for people with disabilities.
And if I could ask, Tom, what is your disability? How did the accident lead you?
I'm an amputee. I have a Symes amputation of my right foot, which means that basically the whole forefoot has been cut off. And then where the knobbly part of your ankle joint is, they went through and cut through that joint and then took my heel bone, my calcaneus, and and butt-jointed that onto the bottom of my tibia, so that I have now my heel bone fused onto the bottom of the tibia, and the small articulating ankle bones taken out of my ankle. And that meant that I kept the fatty pad of my heel. And my prosthesis, if you kind of make a fist, my stump, if you make a fist, is very much like that. It's kind of the leg, the calf muscle has wasted away, and then you have the kind of bony end with the fatty pad. And so it's pretty club-like and not a thing of great beauty, but in terms of function, it's really good, because it means that I can be weight-bearing on the end of my stump. And
I see.
That means that I have a very robust system that doesn't break down or wear out.
Now, how did a guy get from a two-lane highway in Idaho to the top of the world?
Well, I came to I came to the United States following my dream, and my dream was to be a significant presence in big mountain. And in kind of the climbing mountaineering game, there are lots of aspects of it. Part of it is climbing on just on boulders and rocks, and trying to find the way up a boulder that might only be like 8 or 10 or 12 feet high. And if you can't do it, you can just jump back off the boulder. And the idea then is to try and do the hardest possible rock climbs that a human being can do. But there is no real objective danger, because if you do fall off, your friends will what call spot you, and they'll help to catch you and soften your landing and things like that. And then you can go into crag climbing, which is climbing pretty much one pitch climbs that are on 80 to 150 foot perhaps cliffs. And then you get onto the cliff climbing, which is perhaps multi-pitches. So you climb up one rope length to a little place that you can find what you call a stance, a little flat area that you can anchor yourself to the rope, to the rock, and then you bring your partner up, and then you swap leads, and your partner climbs the next pitch above you and finds a little stance, and you do that two or three different times. And then you have what we call big wall climbing, where you now have to climb perhaps 35 of these, one after the other. And there's way more than you can do in a day. And so this becomes a challenge, because now you have to bring all your equipment, water, bedding, food, and even a place to sleep, because sometimes these crags are so that you have to use what they call porter ledges, little portable canvas ledges to sleep in. And then from there you get into alpine climbing, climbing frozen waterfalls, snow gullies, and so you kind of build it up and up and up until you get into the expedition game, where you have to spend a month on a mountain changing your physiology and acclimatizing so that you can stand the extreme altitude without killing yourself. And then when you've got your different camps in place on the mountain, you come back down, you rest up, you eat well, you sleep well, and you wait for the weather to get as good as it's going to get. And then when conditions are perfect and you feel that you're strong enough, you make a bid for the summit of the mountain in one push.
Since many of our listeners probably have not ever seen what a mountaineer carries with him or her, I wonder if you could describe for us how some of your equipment and how you dress. You talk about the ropes and you talk about bringing your partner up. What does all of that look like? How, what are the machinations of that happening?
Well, the equipment that you use for different aspects of mountaineering changed quite dramatically from climbing on sunbaked rock in Yosemite National Park to climbing Mount Everest in the heart of the Himalayan mountain range. And so I think what I'll do is I'll just focus on mountaineering in big mountains. But before I answer your question, let me just say that all my rock climbing and mountaineering that I had done was basically putting together the skills that I would need in the other aspects of climbing so that I could be a significant presence in great mountains, in the really huge mountain ranges. And for this, I needed to know how to use ice tools, the ice axes and the crampons and the ice screws. And I will go on to describe these a little bit, to do the kind of rope work and the intricate footwork that you need to do on vertical rock walls and know how to belay and haul and these other techniques. How to fix lines on faces. And so that in each of the different smaller sub areas of rock climbing, I needed to learn and be proficient at these areas and achieve mastery in them so that I could then take these skills into very remote situations on big mountains and be able to be successful. And so it's a bit like the putting together a jigsaw puzzle of skills so that you can then go and problem solve in this other area that you were super interested in moving into and working in. And for Mount Everest, the equipment generally is that starting at the bottom, you need a good pair of double boots, and they're made out of with a plastic shell, and they're usually pretty ugly. They're kind of a kind of yellowy green color or bright purple or something. I don't know why the manufacturers think mountaineers want these kind of these colors, and they have a rubber sole on them, and then inside that you slide into an inner boot that is laced up the front and has a lot of padding in it and a lot of insulation in it, and is very comfortable and very light to the foot. And that's made out of synthetic materials, and so you put your, maybe wear two pairs of socks, you slide your feet into this, and then you slide your slipper type of laced up the instep into your big double boot that is also super lightweight but very rigid, and you lace that up. And then when you start getting high on the mountain, you have extreme temperatures, then you put that whole thing into something called an overboot, which you slip into and you zip up the front, and it comes all the way up to your knee. And then this whole overboot is insulated with quarter-inch foam under the bottom of it and all around the sides and up the leg. And then you step into what's called a crampon, which has spikes that stick down and will work into the snow and ice, and you strap that onto your overboot. And so your whole foot system is very, very insulated. And then on the upper part of your body, you've got, first of all, some underwear that is long johns from the ankles to the wrist, usually with some kind of polo neck. And that then over the top of that, you have another layer of heavier stuff that would be pile and cover you in a similar kind of way. And that would be also synthetic, very lightweight, very warm. And then over the top of this, you wear a down suit that is like a down comforter and has legs in it. And then it zips up the front. And very important, all these pieces of clothing that you have also zip from the back of your knees in a half moon all the way up to the small of your back and back down to the other knee. So if you can describe like a half D type of thing from the back of your knees all the way up to the small of your back, and you can think of a zipper there, you have a trap door so that if you get caught short out on the mountain and you need to answer nature's call, you can just drop the hatch in the back of your suit and take care of business. And so everything is very function orientated, and this outer down suit has a hood that is sewn onto it, and the hood is really large and has some wire in it. And when you zip the hood up and squeeze the wire, your whole head and face is covered, and there's just like a little mailbox slot where your eyes are sticking out, so that you can see out of this. And then to complete the picture, you wear a pair of ski goggles over your eyes, and you carry a backpack, and in the backpack, you have an oxygen cylinder, which is about as long as from your knee to the ground and probably about the same diameter as the calf of your of a reasonably large-sized individual's leg. It weighs something like 12, 14 pounds. And then you have a tube from there that comes to a mask that covers your nose and mouth and straps onto the back of your head. And then over this whole deal, you put a headlamp, and you carry the batteries to the headlamp inside your down suit, and you have a wire coming up, and the headlamp is on the front of your forehead, and that helps you to see. Because when you're doing some of your mountaineering, you're starting before dawn. And when you're doing your summit push to climb to the summit of Mount Everest, you actually start at 11 o'clock at night. And you climb all the way through the night, getting to the summit hopefully around about 7 or 8 a.m. in the morning before the winds start to blow. And then you're hopefully back down off the mountain about another 5 hours late, back down at your camp where you set out from.
You know, Tom, I think it's probably safe to assume that most of our listeners really don't have a concept of what a mountain looks like, never mind one of the great mountains such as Mount Everest. Could you take a minute and kind of describe to us, what does Mount Everest actually